So welcome to thinking about natural, to describing nature, natural description, and poetry. The third day, I'm Kate Thorpe, if you don't know me, and I'm a grad student at Princeton and also a poet. I have an MFA, and I'm really happy you're all here. Welcome. Let's see. Okay, so we started off on Tuesday talking about 18th century poetry. Yesterday we talked about 19th century poetry, Wordsworth. Today we're talking about 20th century poetry. And the core question of this class has been, what kind of relationship does a poet create by describing nature? What kind of relationship with nature does a poet create? And my basic intention is that through representation, through taking an actual natural object, say a tree, and describing it, having a description in language, that the act of representing that tree creates a relationship with nature. And the core question we've been asking is, what kind of relationship is that? How do we talk about that relationship? A relationship for whom? For the poet? For the speaker in the poem? So the person, we talk about the speaker as the person in the poem, the I, describing things in the poem that's separate from the poet, but connected to the poet. So if there's an I in the poem, it's the speaker, maybe also the poet, but not necessarily. And then what kind of relationship is created for the reader of the poem? So that's one question we've been asking. Another question that's related is, what is the role of figurative language in this description? And we've specifically been talking about personification, which is just like a quick reminder. Who wants to just like quickly remind us? We've been talking about it kind of endlessly. I'm obsessed with personification right now, as you all know. So would someone like to just remind us, what's personification?
Ascribing human qualities to non-human things.
Yeah, to nature. So a kind of basic example, a really like well-known ubiquitous one is Mother Nature, a personification. One cool thing about personification is, I think, helpful for thinking about relationship between nature and humans is that it demonstrates that relationship. We make out of nature a human, like we add attributes to nature. And that leads to the third question, is what's the status of the representation? Is it subjective, a kind of projection of the poet onto nature? A particular lens, a particular framework? Is it objective, the nature itself? Or is it devotional? Is there God? Do we see God in that representation? Say, like, in a book of nature, like, thinking of nature as almost like scripture, something that we, that helps us access God or feel closer to God. Subjective, objective, devotional. And these things are not necessarily separate from each other, right? We've been really finding how closely connected and almost like inextricably tangled sometimes the poet's view is from the nature that the poet is describing. So that's just kind of just a quick reminder of the kinds of things we've been talking about and asking in these really different ways and different kinds of poems. And we really found yesterday that talking about Wordsworth was really different than talking about Anne Finch, who's an 18th century poet, or even like talking about the Robert Hooke's description of the flea. So we started by talking about like the microscope and like specific like descriptions of the flea seen through the new microscope in the 17th century. So that's like a kind of broad overview. I want to dive into some poems, 20th century poems. And then today I want to allow ample time to write. That's really one of my goals for our time today. We've been talking so much about poems, and you've just done an amazing job, really, of like delving in and doing really close reading. And I want to kind of build off of that and allow you to really write and share. Because I feel like I keep going over with it's been so fun to talk about poems.
Yes.
So that's one of my goals, is to really allow time to write too today. Any questions before we get started? Great. Okay, so pass out some handouts. And we're going to read Mary Oliver today. I'm really excited to hear what you have about her.
We'll take it.
Two pieces, huh?
But I'd like to start with, so these are all poems by poets in the writing in the second half of the 20th century. So post-World War II. But I think it's really interesting that we started talking about poems after the revolution, the Glorious Revolution in England. And then the second day, we talked about poems written after the French Revolution. And now we're talking about poems written after World War II. In America, a really different context. Okay, so I'd like to start, before we get to Mary Oliver, I'd like to start with another poet, Denise Levertov. Who's heard of or read Denise Levertov?
Oh,
good,
Seattle
okay.
Poet.
Great, yeah, Seattle poet. Yeah, mm-hmm. Northwest. Denise Levertov. Mm-hmm. Yeah, lived the latter part of her life in Seattle, and a lot of really beautiful poems about nature. So let's start with a poem, The Meteor of Blossoming. And I wasn't quite sure what order I wanted to talk about these. So it's the second page of your handout. And would someone like to read this? Great, thanks.
Meteor of Blossoming. Fully occupied with growing, that's the amaryllis, growing especially at night. It would take only a bit more patience than I've got to sit keeping watch with it till daylight. The naked eye could register every hour's increase in height. Like a child against a barn door, proudly topping each year's achievement steadily up, goes each green stem smooth, matte, traces of reddish purple at the base, and almost imperceptible vertical ridges running the length of them. Two robust stems from each bulb, sometimes with sturdy leaves for company, elegant sweeps of blade with rounded points. Aloft, the gravid buds, shiny with fullness. One morning, and so soon, the first flower has opened when you awake, or you catch it poised in a single brief moment of hesitation. Next day, another, shy at first like a foal, even a third, a fourth, carried triumphantly at the summit of those strong columns, and each a Juno calm in brilliance, a maiden giantess in modest splendor. If humans could be that intensely whole, undistracted, unhurried, swift from sheer, unswerving impetus, if we could blossom out of ourselves, giving nothing imperfect, withholding nothing.
Beautiful. Thank you for reading. You do a beautiful job.
Good reading.
Yes. So I'm curious about how Levertov creates meaning out of this flower. How does she describe the description? Might we begin with a description of the amaryllis? How does she create meaning for us out of this description?
Right away, the amaryllis, it's occupied with growing, thinking about growing, focusing on that.
And the comparing to the child.
Mm-hmm.
The drawing in relationship to what human beings do, and here's the plant doing similarly.
Right. Right, yeah, great. So we start with the plant. So we start with the amaryllis. And we move to the child. Yeah. And we begin with, like, fully, as Joan said, like, fully occupied with this quality of the amaryllis. Remember we talked about 18th century poetry and there are all of these adjectives? It gets really dense with adjectives. So how does Levertov describe, like, without loading it down with adjectives?
Well, that you just said fully.
Yeah.
Fully occupied.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, with growing.
Mm-hmm.
That it's like, it's a verb. It's doing the same.
Yeah.
Yes.
It seems to me there's such a major switch, six lines from the end, that when she stops, stops talking about the amaryllis and gets explicit about what she's been trying to point out. I like it better if it doesn't have it on there, not to be critical. But
wait, say that one more time. If it doesn't, like the move at the end.
Yeah.
The last six. If humans could be that intensely whole.
Yeah.
She doesn't let us draw our own lesson from her description, but she tells us.
Yeah, okay, so that's one of the questions I have for poems, like all the poems we're going to be reading today, is there's often a lesson that's drawn at the end. There's some kind of meaning that's made, some kind of move.
Mm-hmm.
And what do we make of that? What do we make of that move? Yeah, so here we have the amaryllis is compared to a child. So let's come back. Let's hold that and come back to that. We have this, like, final move, meaning... That's, we've like left the amaryllis, right? We're talking about humans by the end.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, she starts with humans herself, or the speaker anyway.
Yeah, can you say more about that?
Well, like as I was listening, what I noticed in terms of structure, and I'm not formal, you know, poetry critic like you, but so it starts off in that first person. It'll take a little bit more patience than I've got, you know, and ends with if humans. But then that the description after the child is fairly objective.
Yes.
It's really just, it's almost not even poetic. It's almost a straightforward description. Now, there's a few adjectives that are not objective, robust stems and elegant sweeps and blades.
Mm-hmm.
But it's otherwise just vertical ridges, reddish purple, you know, how many, and it's, so she seems like she pauses. Here's a picture of what it looks like. And then it goes into, it becomes more of what to me is more poetic in the sense of, you know, carry triumphantly at the summit of those strong called Aegis Juno, a maiden giantess. Like now we're in sort of much more imaginative territory than simply, here's a picture of the flower growing.
Yeah, great.
But there's a little hint. With those two robust stems, it says sometimes with sturdy leaves for company.
Sturdy leaves for company.
And robust. That robust is both it's both descriptive, but also it has these connotations of sturdy, of strong.
She personified that plant, just as the amaryllis, just as an entity unto itself that had intention and and want and and it's yearning to go up and...
Great. So there's this really slippery, there's this movement between the two, like a description, and then this like kind of sliding into something more like personification.
Yes.
Everything seems kind of slow, like things are slow to develop, like at the very end of this first page here, one morning there's the first... And then later on, might be another one. But it doesn't happen all at once. It's just very deliberate and slow.
Well, I almost see the poem itself, its structure, is almost like the stem growing up and the very end of it just blossoming out right at the very end. This whole imaginative, colorful thing just comes right out at the end, almost as if it is, the whole poem is a flower.
Oh, wow.
Right.
Cool.
Nice. Yeah. Okay, great.
And then we've got the comparison. Yeah. So we have the comparison like a child, and then the next one is like a foal.
Like a foal.
That's pretty interesting.
Yeah.
And then we have Juno, and it's not like a Juno. Each a Juno, a maiden giantess in modest splendor.
Can anyone tell me who Juno is?
Queen of the gods.
She's one of the goddesses, but what...
Isn't Juno Jove's wife? Roman gods. So Jove is like the head, the like king of the gods. And Juno, I think, is his wife.
Okay.
So many statues over there were Juno-esque.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that that's right.
Yeah, I'm not very good on the Roman names because they stole them all from the Greeks.
Yes.
Those are the original ones.
So Jupiter, right? Jupiter was the Greek name, right, for Jove.
Yeah.
And then
Hera would be
Juno. Yeah, great question. Yeah, so Juno. So what does that suggest about the amaryllis to compare it to this like queen of the gods? if it's, especially as Robert is saying, like kind of towards the end of the poem, like we can see this movement and pacing even.
Mm-hmm.
Calm in brilliance, a maiden giantess in modest splendor. So we've moved from the Amaryllis' childful Juno, maiden giantess.
Mm-hmm.
Like how, by these comparisons, how is our understanding of this flower changing?
Well, the first two are immature, and then we have the full grown,
mature.
Fully mature.
So fully powerful, fully,
yeah.
Fully charged.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, definitely. Okay, another question. Let's come back to the end in a minute. But who is this? Do we have any clue about the speaker or the address of this poem? Right. So a poem is written for someone, right? Even if it's a soliloquy, even if it's just seemingly for the self, it's for like readers read a poem. Do we have a sense of the audience or the addressee? Yeah.
Well, to me, it starts out with the author sitting there looking at something.
Yeah.
And then describing it, and then thinking about children, and then it goes down here. It opened when you were awake.
Mm-hmm.
You.
Right.
You,
the guy out there.
Suddenly
and
we
it
have
goes
a
on
year.
To the whole gods of the earth and then everything.
Totally.
Right. Fireworks.
Yeah, so remember how, okay, so we talked about Anne Finch in the 18th century and the passive voice, right? And that we got this we, this me, this I pronoun only at the end of the poem, right? We talked about with Wordsworth. There was a lot of I in Wordsworth, right? Like, he was not afraid of saying that, like, he is seeing, or the speaker, the I, is seeing this thing, experiencing these things.
Mm-hmm.
At the end of Tintern Abbey, he turns to Dorothy, his sister. And suddenly there's this address, right, to another human being, that it's not just about him and nature. There's, like, actually some kind of community,
mm-hmm.
some kind of relationship. So how would you frame this poetics, like, Levertov's poetics in this poem, as in terms of the readiness of the speaker or the poet to have a direct speaker observing? Like, where does the poet or where does the...
Well, to me, we start out with her observing,
yeah.
and then with the you, we're there. Now we're invited in.
Great. Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, at the end, we're asked to envision.
Yeah.
So I think without the you, I don't think the ending would be anywhere near as powerful as it is, because it would all just be this distant I.
Right.
Oh, what do you think?
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And whereas the other one, we're drawn in.
Right.
And then presented with that final.
That it, yeah, great.
It's almost like a passage invitation to humans
mm-hmm.
to say, if only we could be like this,
mm-hmm.
you know, if only we could do this. And,
yeah.
Unswerving impetus. We could have that. If humans could do that. So everybody, take a look.
Yeah. And do you think that it gives moral authority? Like, where do you see this poem as moral? Having
mm-hmm.
a kind of moral authority?
I see it more as an invitation, because it's
a
gift.
Invitation.
It doesn't say
if.
Humans
must
be,
must
or
should.
Humans ought to be.
If
I,
could.
Yeah.
To me, it's an invitation.
Yeah.
Because it's all in the conditional.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And then I love how she doesn't finish it.
Mm.
If we have that condition met, then what?
Then
and
what?
There's
That's
no
right.
answer to it.
That's
you
so
take
true.
That way as a reader.
That's so
then
true.
What,
that there's
would my life be?
That this, like, this movement, it ends without even a complete sentence.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
yeah.
God.
Yeah.
Two
then bubble. What? Like, it's almost an implied question, even
right.
though there's also an exclamation point.
Yeah.
That's
yeah.
so
That's
true.
Powerful.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, so we've started with this plant, this flower, and moved to the child, moved to a Roman god. And at the end, we have humans. So I'm curious about whether, is this, okay, so if personification is ascribing human qualities to nature, we clearly have that. But what is that what's happening? We clearly have that, right, when she's comparing the Amaryllis to a child,
mm-hmm.
right? She's like, and we can see this in terms of like really subtle ways with robust, with sturdy leaves for company.
Mm-hmm.
Company suggests it's a person,
mm-hmm.
or it's some kind of animate force
mm-hmm.
in relationship to the viewer.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, at the end, if humans could be that intensely whole, undistracted, unhurried, swift from sheer unswerving impetus. So she now, as Wes was saying, she's described this flower really specifically and kind of empirically, kind of objectively. This move back to humans from the flower is that personification.
Not to me.
Can you say more?
It seems to stand separately.
How so? Yeah.
It seems not so much like it's personification of a flower, but flowerification.
Yes.
Of a
yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Flowerification.
Yes.
Very good.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
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 Wow. The flowerification of a person.
Yes. Yeah. So I'm so interested in this move that, like, it's not. It goes both ways, right? She compares the flower to humans, but she actually also compares humans to flowers. As if it's almost like if only they could be like a flower. Yeah.
Sort of like Jesus does.
Can you say more about that?
Well, consider the lilies of the field, just for instance.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. They don't worry about what they're going to eat and drink. I mean, so be more like a lily.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that if we, like one of the questions that I've kind of brought to this class that we've really been asking is, like what to make of projection? Like, is this a kind of power trip of humans, right? And in this way, like, if we go both, like, it's, I think it's really telling that when it goes both ways, that it's, a like, an evening out, that it's not necessarily a kind of, we've referenced this Platonic hierarchy a number of times now, and how Wordsworth really messes with that hierarchy when he calls humans thinking things. Right, all objects of all thought, thinking things.
Yes.
Yeah.
While we're
yeah.
on this, can I just throw in one more?
Please.
We've been noting all week how our sessions have intersected, and
yeah.
one just occurs to me that I wouldn't have guessed was going to happen. But not only does Jesus say, because they're lilies, but he says in that same paragraph, Solomon in all his glory was not arrayed as one of these,
yeah.
from those flowers.
Yeah.
So he compares Solomon to a flower and says the flower reveals God more than Solomon in all his glory.
Wow.
So since if you're just doing Solomon,
yeah.
an
yeah.
unexpected connection between
that's
flower
amazing.
Poetry and Solomon.
Yes. That's amazing.
That's
so great.
Now, Kate,
yeah.
I also see this, that she comes back at the end when she says, if humans could be, she comes back, her voice comes back, in a hope,
yeah.
as a hope.
Great.
I wish humans could be this way.
Yeah.
Great.
And she includes herself in that.
Yeah.
Yes.
If we could blossom.
Yes.
Yeah.
So the moral authority isn't, it isn't from a, it isn't like from a pedestal.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
oh, I figured all of this out. If only you all would figure
right.
it out.
Right.
It
would be
like,
so different with
yeah.
you.
Yes.
Right? Then it would be pointing.
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
You're a puny thing, you've never figured this out.
That she is also implicated in humans.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a question I just want to kind of keep in the air today as we look at these poems. It kind of comes back a lot. Okay, yeah, so hope, conditional, great. Yeah.
When I read, or you catch it poised in a single brief moment of hesitation, I hear wistfulness in there.
Mm-hmm.
Not just hope, but just some wistfulness, you know.
Yeah.
Oh gosh, it's so beautiful. Oh darn,
mm-hmm.
we aren't.
And hesitation is another of these words that is, yeah, wistful, human-like, but also
yeah.
with a kind of yeah, a kind
still
of
hope,
way.
But you know, next day another.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And she says, one morning, and so soon, that
yeah.
there's that wistfulness.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah, definitely.
Oh, yeah.
Definitely. Great. So, let's see. I was thinking of doing another Levitov poem, but I think we should move on and make sure that we have time to get to everything and still have time for writing. So, let's turn to Mary Oliver. There should be, I'm actually not quite sure where in the packet it is, but it should be pretty accessible. It's the summer day. I think it's the last page.
Second,
no, second to last page. Yeah. Okay, does anyone know this poll?
And what's the name of it?
It's called the Summer Day.
Summer Day.
Yeah. No one knows this poem.
Oh yeah.
Good. I thought so. I thought people would. Okay. Yeah. It's a pretty well-known poem. And I'm curious. I thought I would bring it in here because it's well-known to think about it in light of these questions we've been asking, and to hear how that helps to inform our understanding of the poem. Would someone like to read it?
I'll read it.
Great.
The summer day. Who made the world? Who made the swan and the black bear? Who made the grasshopper? This grasshopper, I mean. The one who has flung herself out of the grass. The one who is eating sugar out of my hand. Who is moving her jaws back and forth instead of up and down. Who is gazing around with her enormous and complicated eyes. Now she lifts her pale forearms and thoroughly washes her face. Now she snaps her wings open and floats away. I don't know exactly what a prayer is. I do know how to pay attention, how to fall down into the grass, how to kneel down in the grass, how to be idle and blessed, how to stroll through the fields, which is what I've been doing all day. Tell me, what else should I have done? Doesn't everything die at last and too soon? Tell me, what is it you plan to do with your one wild and precious life?
Okay, so tell me about the way this poem moves. We talked about in Levertov's poem the kind of structure of starting with the flower and moving in metaphors to human, then human back to flower. Yeah, these movements. So how does this poem move?
The title is interestingly misleading.
Sounds like he's saying, yeah.
Seems so, yes.
It gets so specific.
Yeah.
And there we are with the big questions right away.
Yes. Yeah, okay, great. So we start with questions, and we also end with questions, right?
Mm-hmm. Start with questions.
And then she pulls us into a very individual creature.
Yes. Very specific.
Yeah, very specific.
Like, pretty big questions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then pretty quickly into, like, real specific. So we're back into, like, objective description,
mm-hmm.
as Wes was talking about with the
mm-hmm.
And there's such a lovely interaction between the grasshopper and
the human.
The human.
The interaction, yeah. What kind of interaction? How does that work?
I've never fed a grasshopper. I have no idea you could do that.
Yeah.
I've served a heck of a lot of them in my lifetime, and they're jumping out all over the trail when you walk.
Right.
How in the world do you lie down and offer it sugar and have this, I mean, it's an amazing thing.
Yeah, and okay, so how does she describe this action, this image? Like, how does she describe that? What, like, what does it do to say the one, like, this grasshopper, I mean, we have the I,
mm-hmm.
the one who has flung herself out of the grass.
Right.
So that's already happened.
Mm-hmm.
The one who is eating sugar
mm-hmm.
out of my hand,
mm-hmm.
who is moving her jaws back and forth. How does it change our experience of the grasshopper to have it be in the kind of the like, present progressive, like, that is moving?
It might be just me, but I think it starts out about as heavy as you can get. Who made the world? I mean, Echoes of Blake and Little Lamb, who made it, and all the rest.
Oh, my gosh.
And
if
you get done with that, and all of a sudden we're in a humor. I mean, the grasshopper is, it's, you know, Disney or something. It's
such a great point.
It's humor. And then in the last line, all of a sudden we're back to about as serious as you can get. What are you going to do with your life?
Yeah.
But
everything
in between is light.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, so what would the difference be in this poem if we didn't have the grasshopper?
We would know that grasshoppers' mouths move back and forth.
Yeah, great. So we've learned something in this poem. Actually, we've learned something about this creature.
I didn't know that.
That
nature is interactable with. Mm-hmm. And actually, I get a kind of playfulness about it.
Yeah.
And kind of a care for even the critters, the insects, you know.
That
you can even interact with them in a caring way,
totally.
Offering them food. And,
great.
The wild and unexpected transition from floats away to I don't know exactly what
snaps and floats in the same sentence.
Yes, great point. Yes, so we've talked about how metaphor combines two different things.
Mm-hmm.
It compares things that would normally contrast. Mm-hmm. But here, she's doing this thing where she has, one subject, and then suddenly we're on to another subject. What's the effect of that? Why do that as a poet?
Mm. It seems so intimate. This slow interaction with the grasshopper.
Yes.
Yeah.
I'm looking at, I'm not thinking about other things. I'm having a relationship with this
grasshopper.
Yeah. And how does that relationship change, develop? Meaning, when we move in this really extreme, really dramatic, unexpected way to prayer, we focus so specifically on this intimate relationship. Does it make it seem more intimate and as a result? Less intimate? Like, what does it do to that, to how we think about that relationship, to suddenly move to, I don't know exactly what a prayer is.
Well, to me, it's taking us from a specific event and then the power of reflection. I mean, if you took out the whole grasshopper description and went, who made the grasshopper, and then I don't know exactly what a prayer is, it would just fall flat. You'd be going, what? You're slamming me around? Where am I going? What is this? What's happening? But we get to dive into this relationship with the grasshopper.
Yeah.
And then there is that final, second to the last line, her pale forearms and washes her face.
Yeah.
I mean, that's pretty personified, too.
Yes.
I mean,
I was wondering about that.
Yeah.
Her.
And then we move into prayer.
Yes. Okay, so this is such an interesting point that it's different than Wordsworth's move, right? To say nature, that we have the rolling river, and then suddenly we have the rolls, everything is rolling through it's like he very much takes a specific image and creates this big meaning out of it. But here she doesn't she doesn't overtly personify, right? She doesn't say here's the meaning of the grasshopper. But what do you think that she takes some of the resonance? Basically what it seems like you're saying is that to have the grasshopper gives meaning to the prayer or to the line about prayer.
Mm-hmm.
That there's a relationship between the specifics.
But she says this grasshopper.
That's great.
This grasshopper, not all grasshoppers.
Such a great point. So there's also a claim embedded in this. That not just any, prayer, this thing's something about prayer.
And yet, there's a weird, I don't know if it's exactly irony or a wink at the readers, because what follows is, she plainly knows what prayer is.
That's a great point. So why say I don't know what prayer is? What does that do?
Because
we've
been taught other things about prayer.
Mm-hmm.
That, you have to be in a certain posture and use these big fancy words and,
Yeah, I think she's taking us into the cultural norm, because then it goes down to how to be idle and blessed. When are we we're encouraged to be idle? Said when?
Totally.
When?
Yes.
Are you productive? I mean, we have to explain ourselves as how we are productive. So it's really pulling us away from the cultural norm.
Yeah.
And
okay.
Here we have this life, and how are we going to structure it? How are we going to structure our time in this one life that we have, this one wild and precious life? What are we going to do in here? And here she is, feeding a grasshopper in her hand, right here. And you're just right there, and then, boom!
Yeah.
So I know how to fall down, and I know how to kneel down, and I know how to be idle and be blessed at the same time, which is so far away from I have to be doing in order to be blessed. No.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then I love how she just puts mortality right there. Again, we pretend that we're never going to die, you know, plastic surgery and whatever, whatever. I mean, again, I'm talking cultural, though,
not
necessarily the people in this room, but that's the stick that's held up, you know, always be youthful and you fail somehow if you look old.
And it's so poignant.
Mm-hmm.
And also so sad. Doesn't everything die at last?
And too soon.
Yeah, it's a little bit like the Levertov, like the hesitation,
mm-hmm.
and the like the mourning and like not wanting it to open so quickly almost.
Mm-hmm.
So tell me more about this eye. What does the eye do? Like, wait, so Joan, you were saying that it to say I don't know exactly what a prayer is helps to somehow like acknowledge cultural norms.
Mm-hmm.
Can you say more about that? Like, why, like, does it help that it's in the I voice, even though she clearly does know what, like, this speaker clearly does know what an I is. So why, like, how is the I working that it's not just the speaker?
Yeah, so the cultural norms, like you were just saying, to be idle is not something culturally acceptable or
praised,
and yet she says, and to me this is so intimate, I mean the whole intimate seems to me, this whole thing, she says, tell me what else should I have done?
Tell me.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
So now we're in, we've been in the speaker's perspective, right?
Yes.
I mean, the one who has flung herself, the one who's eating sugar out of my hand. We're like in this perspective, imagining a hand. Now, tell me the imperative voice.
Mm-hmm.
What does the imperative do? What is the imperative? Does that tend to ring a bell for people?
It's like a command. An invitation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
She's inviting.
It's more, it's a challenge.
A challenge, strong command. The
mm-hmm.
imperative voice, do this, shut the door, go outside.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it can also be an order, that
mm-hmm.
tense.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me. It can be an invitation.
Mm-hmm.
I think this is a really good question. What is the tone? So we start with the eye, an eye that, like, seems kind of not quite the eye, that, like, invites us to unsettle cultural norms. Like through this, as if we are the I, maybe. But then by the end, we're in the you. Like there is an I talking to a you.
Mm-hmm.
How is this I to a you different than Levertov's I to a you? Tell me, what is it you plan to do with your one wild and precious life? How do you read that tone?
I think, Wes, you hit it on the head, that it's a challenge. Like, think about, what? Your life is so precious. Really think about what are you going to do with it?
Well, and we were, Joan and I had eye contact because both of our kids graduated from PLU, and they use that as a
freshman to get accepted.
Yeah, what, you know, in a sense of what can you do with your wild and precious life? So, it's interesting.
Did you just line from the poem?
Uh-huh.
That's
great.
Oh, yeah, and in my high school,
I had
teachers who had this, like, a banner across the front of the room the entire year.
Yeah.
That final was there.
Mm-hmm.
Every day, the kids walked in and saw that.
So, okay, so I have a question. Does anyone read this as a judgment?
As a judgment?
Do you read a moral judgment and as a challenge? And also, it sounds like it can be used as motivational. Right? What are you going to do? Like, you are
younger. I hear it the other way around.
Great.
It's a challenge to those who would judge her for being idle and not conforming to that norm. Like,
great.
Tell me, what would you have me do instead?
Yeah.
And then she turns around, so tell me, what would you do?
Mm-hmm.
And I notice the structure ends with this double couplets at the end, which it doesn't follow that. Like, there's the three who made questions in the beginning, then all the other stuff. But there's that those two double couplets at the end.
Yeah.
And that really changes the structure. Tell me what I should have done. Okay, now tell me what you're going to do.
Yeah.
If you think, that is what I hear, that is, if you think that this is a waste of a day, then
yeah.
what are you going to do?
Right.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting you should point out that form, because I heard Mary Oliver read her poetry in Seattle one time, And she stopped between a poem, and it was so funny. She just stood up there with her own books and just went, and she'd flip to a page and read it. I mean, she has handlers. She could have had a whole set of just, no, she read to us out of her books, and then she'd say, and she'd turn a page. You know, she was just doing it on the spot.
Yeah.
But one of the things she said before one poem is, I wrote this in reaction to this form. Mm. And all the years I've been reading Mary Oliver and all the training I've had, I had no idea she was following form. I thought it was all free verse.
Mm.
Because she manages to weave this so naturally. You just, it feels like speaking. It doesn't feel like it. But she manages to weave this form in. And it has more power. But she does it in such a subtle way that it's not like a Shakespearean.
Yeah.
I noticed there are three questions in the front and three questions at the end.
Yeah, so it's a kind of mirror.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, kind of, or chiasmus, if we want to go back to that, like image.
Mm-hmm.
So how does she, I mean, tell me about one last question. Like, she doesn't lead this poem with moral abstractions, right? About meaning or like these big abstract concepts.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a challenging poem in terms of like asking about, kind of like Denise Levertov's poem,
mm-hmm.
about what to do with life, how to use a life.
Mm-hmm.
How does nature help her do that? How does this grasshopper help that, enable that?
Well, she starts it by this one large, you know, kind of worldly, observation or question, sorry. And then she brings it right back down to something very finite, very small.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So, and something that she gets acquainted with.
Yeah. Yeah. Great.
And you know, when I read those opening compared to the ending, to me, the opening would be better framed by the ending if she said, why are we here? You know, why are we alive?
Mm-hmm.
But she doesn't do that.
That's
part of her power, is that she always brings me up short. I think I'm kind of marching along. Mm-hmm. Okay, Mary, where are we going? And then, whoop, all of a sudden I'm somewhere totally different with her going, really? This is where you were bringing me?
Right.
Well, that phrase of coming up short is what that really resonates with, how I experienced this too, and how that ends with, she pretty much calls the questions.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this out of what, you know, it was kind of emerging as you could kind of get an experience of it. But it's not, you can't just look at it.
Yeah.
You know, it's like this calls the questions
mm-hmm.
that you started with.
Yeah.
And so you're stopped short of, okay, this is my question. You're giving me a question that I am to answer. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
That's such a helpful point, that it's that you can't have the morals without the grasshopper.
Yeah.
But you also can't have just the grasshopper.
Right.
Like
right.
The grasshopper
yes.
calls up these
yeah.
questions, these
right.
larger
right.
questions
right.
in us as humans.
Mm-hmm.
That there's something about, like,
mm-hmm.
we've talked about the world is too much with us, this world, Wordsworth's sonnet. And Robert, you pointed so beautifully to how, like, we've given our hearts away, a sordid tune, that in forgetting, like, the world is too much with us, getting and spending, we lay waste our powers. Like, in not seeing meaning in nature,
mm-hmm.
we also lose our own hearts.
Mm-hmm.
That there's this really radical connection that Wordsworth makes between finding meaning in nature
mm-hmm.
and observing and paying attention to nature as a meaningful thing, not just an object,
yeah.
and our own humanity and like human meaning. And I think that's what your comment points to too
mm-hmm.
here, that there are these questions that come up.
I see a devotional aspect to this also because
yeah.
like with definitely because, well, like, where do you meet God? And she calls God up in the first sentence, who made the world, who made?
Yeah.
And then she's like right there, like this. And then it's kind of like what I hear in the prayer is, I don't exactly know what a prayer is. Like, that's some kind of form out here that you're supposed to know, you know, like it's been laid down as to what a prayer is. But here I am, I'm meeting God out in the nature. I spent my whole day in out here. Should I do anything other than meet God every wherever I go?
Right.
Being idle and blessed.
Right.
I would think.
And blessed.
That's almost sacrilege.
And should big questions be answered with small things?
Mm. I love that.
I think it pricks it pricks human pride. I mean, you start out with stock grandeur images, the swan, you think of real P-N-E-8s and a few others, that's the only black bear, big and powerful, now we're going to look at a grasshopper. And it's brevity, it appears out of the grass.
Yeah.
It's the old thing about what are we here, you look around once and then you die. It's short.
Yeah.
So it pops out of the grass, got big eyes, chews a little bit, eats, and then gone. So that's...
Wonderful.
Just genius.
Let's shift from this really fertile place of talking about what the relationship between nature and humans to thinking about objects. So let's, like, if everyone can just get kind of close to a piece of paper and a pen or pencil, I'm going to shift over. And I'd like you to describe your object that you've chosen. You could think about all of the strategies we've seen so far. So we've seen questions, answers, really specific description of sight, sense, smell, touch, right? Like how a person interacts with an object, the I, the you, all these different kinds of pronouns can fit in. We didn't talk about a poem that has quotation marks. You can have quotation marks in speech. All these different, the big to small, all these kinds of movements. You could think about all of these strategies to talk about objects and make meaning. So, yeah, feel free to write prose, poetry, lines. Can rhyme, doesn't have to rhyme. It's totally up to you how you want to approach this. Formally, and yeah, and if you want to, we can go around and talk about them. You're free to share or not. It's yeah, there's no pressure. Yeah, good. So let's spend a good 10 minutes and see where everyone is. Great. So I thought we would. So we have a few minutes left. I thought we would go around, and if you could just show us your object, kind of a show and tell. Show us your object, and I'm curious about. You can either read what you wrote, feel free if you like to do that, or tell us about your process. What was this like for you? What did you learn about your object through writing about it? Did you see different things than you had seen at first? Did you feel like it told you anything? Like, did you feel like you had a relationship to this object? Just to kind of throw out some questions you could address if you want. Great. Is that clear?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Great.
I'll
Joan, you want to start? Perfect.
So this is my object. And I'm just going to read what I wrote.
Perfect. That's great.
There it was, lying on the ground, dirty, scraggly, dry. Its fragility drew me closer, and then, oh lovely surprise, I saw a face. The face of a bird. Is it a heron? Is it an eagle? From a tree sturdy, rooted, came the gift, an image of a creature free to fly, free to search for food, to soar toward heaven, toward God, the Creator, who holds this beloved creature and who delights in him.
This is what was writing from the beach. As I walked the well-worn path to the flowing creek, my eyes searching the vista of rocks and sparse foliage as for a treasure to ponder, the sun rays reflecting off an object, silvery, orangish copper, nestled in the leaves. A strange intruder, cylindrical in form, coated in the reddish dust and dirt. A moment of revulsion. and anger that someone had ruined my momentary search for beauty and connectedness in nature.
Well, this is my object, and it's a rock I picked up. It's got little stains on here, and if you look at it, if you look at it in the sun, like when it's wet, there's these sparkles that come off, like this. And I said, and I was the rock. I said, I was rescued from the river's edge where my kaolin siblings still lie. The staining from my grinding birth is covering my side. I survived a tumult where my temple was torn down, a temple mother where I lived for tens of thousands of years. Even though our sibling bonds were broken, the spirit within me still sparkles. No matter how small they break me down, I'll always reflect my maker.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
Well,
you guys.
You
better take that home,
Robert. I think with that I'm going to pass.
Can you just tell us about your object?
Pardon?
Can you show us your object?
Well, the object was just the stone.
Mm-hmm.
And I picked it up on the way back, on the road back.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason it interested me is as we walked down, we saw more and more rock and the ability to get up here and explore the whole area. Basically, it's because the roads are so wide and they have done so much work and there's so much stone in it. It's not like the old muddy roads they used to. Of course, it wouldn't be muddy now, but and I just thought this was just what's happened up at Holden to allow us to enjoy it. So.
Great. What was it like to describe it?
Pardon?
What was it like to describe it or write about it?
It's just solid rock. It's got sharp edges that stick together, like that, and it keeps. It's almost like pavement, but it's not. It's just plain old rock that's been run down, been driven over, we were thinking, what a difference this has made to get us around here.
So you were appreciating it because of a human ability to enjoy it. It wasn't like looking at a rock face somewhere. So it's all
no. It's just a piece of rock, and it's got. You go up and down the road, you find little rocks, different shaped rocks, and there was nothing particular about it. It's just that it was solid.
Makes
and
a great road.
And made a great road to allow us to enjoy this place.
I love how already we're getting all of these questions of nature, like objects that are totally separate from humans, or found by humans, but connected, like through metaphors, through seeing as a face, connected to humans, but also objects that are directly, integrally human made, or like for humans, like all of these things, like we can't quite extricate, is that a word? these like human and nature. Yeah, great. Thank you so much for sharing. Yeah.